from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll take a look at Madeline Albright's pin collection.
I'll talk with artist Walter Knobby about the time he spent working for Andy Warhol.
And I'll get a preview of what's coming up at the Indiana History Center. Plus, we'll have our Arts Calendar Week Hall.
What'll we do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Throughout history, jewelry has not only adorned men and women, but has also served as a clue to its wearer's social status, economic health, and even their political leanings. Need proof? Well, make plans to see Read My Pins, the Madeline Albright Collection, a major traveling exhibition of the former Secretary of State's fascinating pins, opening at the IMA November 7th. IMA curator of textile and fashion arts, Neelu Paidar, dropped in to tell Sharon Gamble all about it.
Okay, so how does it happen that someone in one of the most influential political positions in the world, years later, has an exhibition of jewelry that is a tribute to her? That's fascinating.
It is fascinating. Madeline Albright writes about this, that like any other women, she had some pins, and she likes to call them pins and not brooches. And she also says that none of it would have happened if it weren't for Saddam Hussein, because his press had called her a serpent. And then in one of the other meetings that she had right after this comment, she wore this pin that's it's a snake, and it's actually quite beautiful. And then the press picked up on it, and they asked her, why is she wearing this snake pin? And she said it was because of Saddam Hussein's press people that had called her a serpent. So then from now on, she realized that these pins can be used to convey messages and her feelings, and getting some words across, which is quite interesting. And she has about 300 pins in her collection, and 200 of them will be on display at the IMA.
How far back do brooches or pins go? My sense is they've been around for a really long time.
Well, historically, jewelry has been worn, and they are a sign of prestige, and in many cultures, pieces that are made of either precious stones or just, you know, shells were always used to adorn people's bodies or, you know, garments. So it is an ancient, sort of a accessory.
Mm-hmm. And men and women, both.
Both, yes. Yeah. And, it's really difficult to date it, but it is ancient and, you know, the tradition continues.
Was there any... Were there any repercussions? Was there any pushback from the wearing of the snake pin that we're aware of?
Not really, no. She actually enjoyed all the attention she got. And this is, you know, she really credits this event to the start of using the pin collection as ways of communicating. And, you know, she calls them, they were powerful symbols that send diplomatic messages.
Now, I've read also that sort of in parallel to the president saying "Read my lips," she said "Read my pins."
Yeah, that's very true, and that's where she got the term "Read my pins," because she said that she would be in office and people would ask her, you know, what's going on, and she said "Read my pins," and that was her answer to people. And a lot of times, you know, they would convey the mood or her either positive mood or negative mood or all the things that were going to take place during that day. So she would wear a pin accordingly.
Were there times when she was in her position, when she had to change pins, because, you know, those are pretty full days she would have had. You know?
I know that that's really an interesting question, and I don't know the answer answer to that, but I plan to ask her because
she's going to be here
at the IMA on November 11th, and hopefully I have a chance to talk to her. So I will ask her that question.
What are some of the shapes and designs, and are any of them super traditional, or are they all more contemporary? With 300 pins, there's probably the answer is yes, 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 right?
Yeah, basically yes. There are all sorts of pins in her collection. There are some that are antiques. There are some contemporary pieces, some just costume jewelry, some beautiful ones, some that have sentimental values. For example, there is one that her daughter made when she was 5. It's a beautiful little ceramic heart, and she says that she wears it every Valentine's Day, except for the time during this whole run of the exhibition, which has been on exhibit, so she didn't have a chance to wear it. So there's a whole different, range of pins, and some really beautiful, some very ornate pieces in the collection.
Did jewelers, after they realized, hey, here's an opportunity to get somebody who is widely influential and widely photographed to wear my work, did have designers, both when she was in office and now in retirement, sent things her way?
Well, she certainly got a lot of pieces at gifts, and she also looks for them. And she collects some, contemporary pieces by contemporary jewelry maker. They're not all jewels. They're little pieces of sculpture. Hmm. And they're quite beautiful. So, hopefully if I can find the right one, I can, I hope to give one to her. But it's so difficult to find the right pin for somebody who has a huge collection. So we'll see, if I can find a nice one.
How is the exhibition arranged? Are they chronological? Are they themed?
Well, as you know, the exhibition was organized by the Museum of Art and Design, and then it went to the Clinton Library. And right now it's at the Smithsonian, and it will come to us. It's a package show, so basically it's organized not chronologically but more thematically. And the first one, obviously, is the snake pin, and then it goes on to show some of the more important ones that she wore during different meetings. There's one zebra one that's quite beautiful that actually sits on the shoulder, and that's the one that she wore when she met Nelson Mandela. And then there is the one with the shattered pieces of glass symbolizing the shattered ceiling because she was the first Secretary of State. So those are the more interesting and important ones. And what's great about this exhibition is that there are images of her wearing these and meeting with these dignitaries, and they're included in the exhibition so people can see the pin. And then on the bottom, there's a picture of Secretary Albright wearing it, and meeting with these people. So that is a great compliment.
Sure, and it's a beautifully sneaky way to get people to remember history and learn more about history and world politics as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
What are some of your favorite pieces?
Well, I have a lot of favorites. There's one that I particularly like, and she talks about that at great length, is the Atlas pin. And it's it's a man holding up the world. And she says that she wore that during difficult times and intense negotiations, and the weight of the world, I guess, was on her shoulders. So that is one of my favorite ones. And there's another one that was given to her by the son of a victim of Katrina, and that was given to her when she was in New Orleans. And it's a great touching story that comes with that pin. But there's so many favorites. I like the snake pin too. It's quite beautiful.
Do we know? Did she have advisors who said? Whoever said, hey, this person you're about to meet with has this particular background he or she might respond well to this particular pin or might be especially intrigued by this particular pin? We'll have to ask her when she's here.
I honestly don't know, but she's a very smart woman, and I'm sure she did her homework and she knew who she was meeting, and, you know, so she knew the occasion, I guess, the best, perhaps.
What's involved with receiving this exhibition and installing it? How complicated is that?
Well, I think you want to represent the art the best. And, you know, knowing what we do at the IMA, I think we're going to have a great installation. You just want to make sure that the message throughout the exhibition is conveyed and the art is installed the best way. And we just hope that people really enjoy the show.
You know, it's interesting. Do we know why she prefers to call them pins instead of brooches?
Well, I saw in an interview with Katie Couric, which we'll have hopefully that interview running through the length of the exhibition, that she sort of feels that it's more an outdated kind of expression, and more old ladies, perhaps. And
sounds like something grandmother might have had.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, I think she might be responsible for pins coming back into vogue, because there was a time when people weren't wearing them very much at all.
Not really. No, you're right. Yeah, so, yeah, there's a revival of the pins. And I hope everybody who comes to meet with her on that November 11th program that we have, where's their favorite pin?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
And then we'll have a book signing for her afterwards. And the talk is at 7 p.m. on Thursday, November 11th. So this is the best opportunity to hear her in conversation with our director, Maxwell Anderson, in the Toby.
I am a curator of textile and fashion arts, Neelu Pidar, with Sharon Gamble. Read My Pins, the Madeleine Albright Collection, a major traveling exhibition, opens at the IMA November 7th. Albright will give a talk with a book signing at the Toby at the IMA at 6 p.m. on Thursday, November 11th. Find out more and get tickets for the talk and the exhibition at imamuseum.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. A designer since the age of 14, Walter Kanabe obtained his master's degree in fine arts from the University of Wisconsin and later painted under Andy Warhol before applying his techniques to painting and limited edition printmaking. Walter first opened a studio nearly 30 years ago as a painter in New York City. His paintings quickly morphed into full-scale wall coverings when he received a request to cover the walls of a high-profile New York apartment with his heavily patterned paintings. Since then, his studio has also produced wall coverings, fabrics, and other home decor, utilizing some of the same screen printing techniques he developed while working for Warhol. Travis DiNicola spoke to him about his Warhol experience and the current show featuring both their work, titled Walter and Warhol, at the Art Box Gallery.
Walter, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you in our studio today.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
I am so excited about, well, just everything sort of going on in Indianapolis right now that's connected with Andy Warhol. Of course, the exhibition at the IMA, but also the show at Art Box that opened beginning of October, Walter and Warhol, which we're going to talk about in just a minute. But, you know, I think the first time I met you was probably maybe, 15 years ago in your studio at the Stutz. You are are known not just locally but internationally for your silkscreen work, your amazing wallpapers in the homes of lots of people locally, as well as some famous one-name people, I suppose.
Well, that's right. Yeah.
Tell me just a little bit about that, because that's you've got a really amazing career going on.
Well, it was originally designed as divisively to be able to make a living off art. So being a young upstart in New York City, it was really about finding a way to make a living off doing my art.
Now, are you from Indianapolis, though?
No, my wife is from here. So that was the gravity. That's why we moved here from New York City.
I see.
I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Okay. Because, I mean, it's pretty cool that you're here and working here in Indy and have this great reputation and all that stuff. And we're very, you know, thankful to have you here. But so, let's go back. Let's take the, as Sharon, my co-host, says, the time machine and the way back machine.
Machine, indeed. We're going back to 1980.
So 1980, and, you know, at that time, I mean, what artist in the United mm-hmm. States would not want to work with Warhol? I mean, he was, I mean, that was, you know, from early 60s on, I mean, whether it was at the Factory or Interview Magazine or Velvet mm-hmm. Underground, I mean, there were so many cool things that were sort of centered around Warhol. Who wouldn't want to work with him at that point?
Well, that's very true, but the irony is that a group of us who left finished graduate work at University of Wisconsin and went out to New York City. The irony is that we were actually more interested in the younger artists that were coming up, the people that were showing it, like Mary Boone or some of the stragglers at Leo Castelli and mm-hmm. just that whole art scene. So it was almost like at that point, even though Andy Warhol was certainly an icon,
mm-hmm.
He was not the main focus in terms of what was going on there at that time.
Okay.
So we were, we were more excited to be meeting Basquiat and people like that.
Sure. Now, Basquiat was someone who mm-hmm. also had been doing some work with Warhol.
Well, right? That's right. He did end up hooking up with him at the time that I had met him briefly, mm-hmm. though. Basquiat was painting in the basement of an art gallery.
Hmm.
So, I mean,
okay.
It was pretty different.
So and actually, I mean, Warhol was in his 50s, I think, by that point, by the 80s.
Sounds about right.
So you go off to New York with your friends from grad school
mm-hmm.
and trying to sort of, get into the scene there, and
yeah.
certainly some very cool stuff going on at the time.
Absolutely.
What happens next?
Well, I think I had been invited to come to this gallery. There was obviously at doing graduate work, they'd bring a lot of people in to speak or to come in and look at your work in that. And there was a gallery owner who seemed to have an interest in my work. And she said, come see me when you get to New York. And it felt like she was, you start to fantasize at that age
mm-hmm.
thinking that, oh, move to New York, I'll get a one-man show my first week there, and everything will be just awesome. So I go to see her and get the big letdown that she can't show my work. But that she knows a couple of artists that are looking for basically gophers.
Okay.
So
not a one man show.
Yeah. Now, right. Exactly.
Were you doing silk screens at the time? I mean,
actually, I wasn't. I used to hate silk screening.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I thought it was just god awful. I mean, you would have stencils. You'd have to cut these things out.
Yeah.
It was like, this is just A, way too tedious, and B, just not my kind of work.
Wow. Okay.
So the epiphany was seeing that you can do photo silk screens
yeah.
and take any kind of image and really manipulate these things and create multi-layers and multifaceted pieces out of that process.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so well, that's quite an evolution of your work right there. So, so you get
Absolutely.
This opportunity if you want to be a gopher,
mm-hmm.
And so where does that go?
Well, it was off and on for about a period of 5 years.
Yeah.
So I think in reminiscing about this, and obviously doing the show, it brought a lot of things to light and that. And it's funny because I realized the real crux of it for me was it wasn't only working with Andy Warhol, it was being a part of that whole sphere that was going on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing. In retrospect, it was a lot more interesting than it was being in the middle of it at that time. And I think we kept thinking that, oh my gosh, the golden era is over. That was pop art
mm-hmm.
and what happened in the 60s and that. And what was going on in the early 80s was kind of mock, hysteria. So, but it turns out that it was its own generation, and it actually was the last big boom for art during that time period.
Well, it's interesting. I was actually talking to my wife about this the other night, sort of about what was going on during that time period in the early
mm-hmm.
80s in New York, and she asked me, has there been anything else like that mm-hmm. since? And I was really trying to think of, where you had that many creative people sort of working
right.
together in that type of, close proximity, mm-hmm. and I really
yeah.
couldn't come up with anything.
I can't either. It's very interesting. I mean, the German Expressionists were making a big boom at the time. Castelli and Sonnabend were
mm-hmm.
showing Anselm Kiefer and just tons of his work. He was showing it maybe three or four galleries at a time.
Sure.
I mean, it was really amazing the amount of stuff that was going on. And it was certainly in tandem with the economic boom.
Yeah.
I mean, it was exceptional.
So, I'm sure you've been asked this, but I got to know, sort of what your impression of Andy Warhol was when, when you first met him, as you were
uh-huh.
working with him.
Right.
And there's so many,
odd and interesting stories out there about him.
Well, that's right, yeah.
Everything from, you know, genius to sort of just, you know, mm-hmm. very quiet, shy guy, I mean, and everything in between. So.
Well, it was all of that and more. depending upon the day and depending upon the circumstance and depending upon who the people were in the room. I mean, it was very interesting. The studio that I was in, which I guess was his last one, was up by 32nd Street in Madison, and it had a front door and a back door. And the back door is set up so that he could had an escape route if somebody was coming and he wasn't interested in seeing them.
Well, he was kind of notorious for that, wasn't he? Like just sometimes didn't want to.
Yeah, I guess so. He was pretty moody, mm-hmm. I would say.
Yeah.
But very bright, very interested in what everyone had to say, because he would process people's opinions and then somehow percolate those into ideas, which was a fascinating approach. I mean, I adopted that just a little bit.
And just, sure, I mean, just to see that process.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's exactly right, that that it really set the bar pretty high, but also showed what was possible, both in terms of artwork, but also in terms of making a living as an artist.
Now, when you were there, you were just sort of helping with production work, or...?
kind of all the above. I started off unpacking letters and boxes and stuff like that, but it was whatever we needed to be doing at the time. He had a central core of people that he worked with, that he was very close with.
It was like I'm trying to picture, like, mm-hmm. a group of, like, 10 of you, 100 of you?
There was about... It depended on what was going on. Yeah. But there were 8 or 10 people in the office area and sure. running around, sure. depending upon what we were doing. A lot of the screen printing was done out of house, so mm-hmm. it wasn't even done there. The additions and that. A guy by the name of Rupert was doing those. Who was he was right around my age, so he was pretty young when he started doing his additions for him.
Huh.
And it was amazing how young he was.
So while you were there, one of the things you did was you took some photographs.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and some of those photographs are on exhibit as part of the Warhol. I'm sorry, the Walter and Warhol show, right?
I believe yes. There's going to be a couple. One of them I just recently moved and my studio, and one of them is missing. Along with some other things, but we hope to find those here.
I mean, you had to meet some really interesting people.
I did, but you know it's funny. A lot of those people were very guarded as they came in.
Yeah.
So a lot of the most interesting people that I met as a consequence of doing my own work, which was very interesting. And again, I think to try and give a bigger picture to what was going on at the time, you would see all these other very well-known artists whose work you admired all the time, and you'd be meeting up with them, seeing them in bars or down in Soho, which was, of course, the booming place at the time.
Sure.
And that was always very exciting.
Now, how long did you end up staying in New York then? Before did you go right from New York mm-hmm. to Indianapolis then?
Did absolutely. As a matter of fact, the van came up, packed my studio up, and dumped it on a loading dock downtown here at the Stutz Building.
Right from New York to the Stutz. Yeah.
Well, so, exactly.
So that was what, like late '80s for you?
That was no. We moved here. Geez, I can't remember the year. I guess I want to say 93,
okay.
maybe?
Yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
Okay. So you've been in New York then working for quite a while, and then certainly, you know, after Andy Warhol had died and continued.
Oh, yeah. We were in New York for 15 years.
Yeah.
So
tell me about some of the other work that the people are going to see at the Walter and Warhol mm-hmm. show over at Art mm-hmm. Box.
Well, I'm very excited to say that the Warhol work that's up, and there's a couple originals, and other editions are from the time period that I was working there, from like 1980 to 85.
Yeah.
So that's kind of fun. And I think what I'm finding most interesting is I keep saying, you know, I really wasn't affected by his work, and it really didn't. You don't really see much of it there. But when you start to look at my work at across the wall from his, mm-hmm. you do see quite a bit of influence.
That maybe you weren't aware of at the time.
Well,
sort of become aware of now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right. Huh. And I kept thinking, well, it's the same process, but it's terribly different. I think what is most different is that a lot of the pop art people, including Andy Warhol, were not interested in having an emotional content to the work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what I'm all about.
Yeah.
It's about having an emotional content, a human content, and having a human narrative. What's going on with the work, So in that way, my work's very different, because that's me. I'm very different from
sure.
that.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Tell me about some of the things you're working on now. I know recently you had a show not too long ago at the Laurie Gallery, and of course you're doing other work still.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, I just moved into a couple months ago, new studio in the Indiana Design Center up off Rangeline Road up in the Carmel Arts and Arts District. And it's gorgeous space to begin with, so it's really been inspiring and very upbeat and positive. So it's really kind of opened it up even more, and I'm getting very prolific with the work. It's getting into some more portrait type work, which you'll see at the show.
Okay.
And these portraits are more personal narratives about the people than just frontal photographs of their profiles or whatever. So it's interesting. There's more, again, emotion shown with the expressions that you normally don't see in portraits. So I'm exploring that aspect.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, certainly looking forward to seeing those. One thing I want to go back to just regarding Warhol and this show, since it is Walter and Warhol. You know, I mean, for many people, when they think of Andy Warhol, I mean, they, you know, the first thing they think of course, is, you know, the soup cans or some of the other, you know, the pop art portraits and such.
Yeah.
But, you know, his influences were so great and varied. I mean, what is the, you know, sort of the one thing that you hope that the people will be, you know, sort of maybe learning or taking away from both the show at Art Box as well as the IMA. You know, I think even for a number of younger artists, they may not even sort of recognize the, you know, what a presence he was for so many years.
Yeah, the influence is really amazing. I mean, it's not only that he is probably the best and best selling artist of all time, pretty much, and probably the most expensive at this point. But it's interesting. I think there's reasons behind that. One being that graphic look has resurfaced again, if you will, or coming to a new crescendo. And I think that's because of all the social networking and just the ease of people taking pictures these days.
Yeah,
it's interesting. People say, gosh, you only have a few photos from that time period. And you have to remember that, you know, unless you carry an Instamatic camera around with you, which most people don't even remember
film
by name.
Film was expensive.
Exactly.
Developing was expensive.
Yeah, you didn't do that. It was very it was very obtrusive to turn to someone and take their photo.
Yeah,
now it's
even
it's
the
prolific.
Act of it. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, so it was a very different time, which that also I thought of in retrospect. It's really fascinating how much it's changed.
Travis DiNicola with artist Walter Knobby. The show Walter and Warhol runs through November 5th at the Art Box Gallery at the Stutz Building. More information at artboxindy.com. You can also learn more about Walter Knobby and his work at walterknobby.com. Walter, common spelling, KNABE.com. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
You know, I know for a fact that there are some people listening right now who just never got around to making that pledge recently or renewing their memberships. So I'm going to invite all of those folks. You know who you are. We're not going to come and sit on your doorstep. But I invite you, while you're listening to our calendar events, to cruise on over on your computer to WFYI.org. It's not too late.
It's never too late.
That's right.
Great.
So, meanwhile, what are they going to do to reward themselves after they feel great about
then
renewing?
I think you should like get tickets to a great show or go to an art gallery.
I
who knows
it.
What else that we'll talk about on?
What do we do?
Yeah.
Love that.
Well, what I'm thinking about doing, actually, is in a couple weeks, I want to go see Dreamgirls at Old National Center, the Marat, downtown. And what's really cool about that is that this production, it is a touring production, but it's featuring some local talent. Moya Angelou. She is from, she plays Effie and is a graduate of North Central High School.
Cool.
And she's done several productions with Footlight in the past. And then also Chester Gregory, who plays James Thunder Early, is originally from Fort Wayne. So we've got some local talent in this show. Moya Angela and Chester Gregory in the touring production of Dream Girls, which opens November 2nd and runs through the 7th at the Old National Center Marat.
What a feel-good show. Love that. Speaking of shows, there's a lot of theater going on right now. Your chances are dwindling to see Holes on stage at the IRT, regardless of whether you're familiar with it. Maybe your kids read it, or you read it as a younger person, or maybe you saw the hit movie. It's a fantastic stage adaptation going on at the IRT through November 6th, so make your plans now.
That's right. Hey, some more theater. Shame, the adaptation, the musical adaptation of The Scarlet Letter that's taking place at University of Indianapolis, is going on this weekend at Esch Hall, Randsburg Auditorium. You maybe heard the interview a couple weeks ago with Peter Schmutte and Brad Wright. Should be a lot of fun. I know who thinks of fun and Scarlet Letter in the same you know, show, but it could happen. So check out Shame.
Speaking of theater, this sounds like it might be part of the Spirit and Place Festival. It really isn't. It just is a lucky coincidence. It's the Kitchen Witches, two cooks who have hated each other for 30 years, one show where insults are flung harder and faster than the food, a cable TV ratings smash, and a frothy recipe for bawdiness
frothy.
And belly laughs. I know, I can see the whisk. It's by Caroline Smith, and it's on stage now at Theater on the Square. It's called The Kitchen Witches. Be careful how you say that.
That sounds good. Hey, speaking of Spirit in Place, though, Michael Pollan, who is the author of Food Rules as well as Omnivore's Dilemma, is coming to town, and this is part of Spirit in Place. He's going to be speaking at the Scottish Rite Cathedral on Friday, November 12th, from noon until 1:30. And Barbara Lewis, who is the host of WFYI Sound Medicine, is going to be interviewing Pollan about food. It's all part of the Food for Thought theme. You do need tickets for this. They're $15 or $25, and you can get them online if you go to Spirit in Place to get more information. I got my tickets today.
All right.
I'm very excited about
Fantastic.
Going to see that. It should be a lot of fun.
Hey, pianist Dave Hepler and bassist Frank Smith are doing a show together this Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock at the JCC, and it's called Warm Jazz on a Sunday Afternoon. It's $6 if you're a JCC member, $10 general public, and it's at the JCC. What more can I say? It should be a pleasant, pleasant afternoon.
There are so many cool things that that are going on sort of in conjunction with Food for Thought, and we'll be talking about more in the coming weeks. But one of them I just want to sort of give you a heads up on, Big Car Gallery, which has been on recently, in fact talking about all the cool stuff they're doing in the neighborhoods with different community art projects, is putting on a chicken-inspired reading and art show. That's right, Sharon. Chicken.
Since I have chickens living next door to me in my urban neighborhood, I'm intrigued. Go on.
Okay, it opens November 11th. It's part of Food for Thought. And
is this the one called The Chicken Show?
It's exploring chickens as art, inspiration, human companions as food, whether that's free-range or factory-farmed.
Oh.
And they're bringing in Michael Perry, a writer and memoirist, and they're also actually looking for artists to make chicken art as part of it. If you check out Big Car Gallery, you can get more information.
Okay. And on another occasion, listeners, I'll tell you about the chickens who live next
door
to
chicken
me.
Chicken wire art. Or
egg art.
Yeah.
I see it. Shifting gears completely. At Butler University, there's a seminar on religion and world civilization. This is part of a series, and this is going on Tuesday evening at 7 o'clock. It's free. You do need a ticket. It's at Clues Hall. Tickets are limited to two per party. But it is called The Future of Islam, and it's a wide-ranging conversation about modern Islam and how and what its role is in global politics and global spirituality. So The Future of Islam, Tuesday evening at 7 o'clock, Clues Memorial Hall. Call and get your tickets. They are free, but you do need tickets.
Very good. I know people are thinking about Halloween and making plans for that.
Ooh.
Ooh. And may I suggest checking out the 2010 Irvington Community Halloween Festival, which is taking place in the Irvington neighborhood on the east side, just off of East Washington Street. And their big festival takes place on Saturday, October 30th, from 10 a.m. until 4:30, with food and entertainment and arts and crafts and games and magic show and silly safaris and all types of cool stuff going on. Lots of great stuff for kids. Lots of stuff going on that's part of the Irvington Library, as well as all the different businesses that are there with live entertainment and a couple different stages. Also, something to consider doing between now and then, though, is checking out the Haunted Irvington Ghost Tour. You can get your tickets at Lazy Days Coffee House. Also, Cabaret Poe is performing out there, and there's all types of other cool stuff mm-hmm. always going on in Irvington. But the haunted tour of Irvington, I did a couple years ago. A lot of fun. Very cool. There's a lot of interesting haunted houses
there
out there.
There are. Most of the ghosts are pretty friendly, though, from
For the
what
most
I understand.
Part. Yeah.
Hey, you know it, you love it. Neil Simon's Plaza Suite. It's being performed at the Scottish Rite Performing Arts Center. That's inside the Scottish Rite building. And our own Matt Soucy directed this production. The remaining performances are this Saturday night at 7:30 and this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock.
Very
Plaza
good.
Plaza Suite at the Scottish Rite.
And last thing that I just wanted to give a heads up on is that it is the last weekend for the play In the Next Room or the Vibrator play at the Phoenix Theater. And tickets are still available for that play. A Victorian, oh, not quite comedy, but certainly interesting story worth checking out at Phoenix Theater.
That's a hard subject to follow up. Except that I can say this while Travis recoils in horror and decides whether or not to leave that into the broadcast. Butler creates an alumni gallery tour. There's a special kickoff event this Sunday afternoon at 1:30 at Clues Memorial Hall. Free admission, ticket not required. Just show up if you're curious about Butler artists.
Free is good.
Free is good.
Well, we'll be back with more horrific things next week, I'm sure, on
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Amy Lamb and Aaron Kelly are delighted that their home away from home, the Indiana History Center, is open and full of activities after its recent renovation. Sharon Gamble invited these employees of the Indiana Historical Society in to learn more about the programming on tap for this fall.
So I know there's a lot going on all the time, but this seems like an especially crowded fall. How did that happen?
What happened? Aaron, how did that happen?
How do these things happen to you? You know, the fall is just a great time. I mean, it's a wonderful time to be out and to enjoy the community, and that's what we're about, is creating opportunities for people to come to the History Center and have a good time with us.
Now that you've been reopened for a while, what is the general effect? Are people generally pleased with the changes?
I think so. You know, just the fact that you can come in and spend a half day or a full day at our location, and then, of course, we are close to so many other wonderful attractions on the canal, people can really make a day of their trip with us, whether it's spending a lot of time in the You Are Theirs, where you get to walk through that historic photograph, and on the other side, you meet the people from the photograph and learn more about the time. We have lots of people who come in and use the touch screens for an hour or an hour and a half, just scrolling through countless images from our collection. We have just 15 new journeys that we added late this summer, and then we'll be adding another 10 to 15 journeys every 6 months. So there's always something new to see when people come back. So we're hoping that we're getting those repeat visitors,
what
too.
What are some of your favorite new journeys?
Well, the World War II ones are really interesting, and I think that hits a niche that a lot of people were looking for us to fill since they weren't part of the original grouping. We have things on Indiana University and Purdue University, so there are lots of people who can come in and see a little bit of their own personal past. In there we have some journeys from Eli Lilly and Company, including one new big screen journey that we launched. So if you want to learn about one of the major philanthropic supporters of our community, it's a great way to see how they made their fortune to help us in turn.
And how do you decide? Is it just based on artifacts and materials you have already, and you think, gosh, we seem to have a density of information about this particular subject or this particular area of commerce or whatever? Is that how you decide?
Yeah, well, there's a combination of things. You know, when we prepare Destination Indiana journeys, there's definitely a cost to that. So in some cases, whether it's the Arthur Jordan Foundation interested in having us highlight that family's legacy. We might partner with someone financially on that. We also have partnerships with places like the Rivers Institute at Hanover College, bringing life on the Ohio River to life. We have some things in our collection, but they had a wealth of images that really added to that. So in most cases, you'll see our images from the IHS collections, but on occasion, we do partner with other people. So it's a variety of finding subject matter that people are interested, finding out some of the strengths of our collections, and then also finding the money to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. You have a book and author fair coming up, and as we're having this conversation, it's just turned fall, and that'll be here before we know it.
Yes, it's December 4th, the Holiday Author Fair. It's the largest grouping of Indiana authors that you'll see in the state every year. We're really excited. We have a lot of new books that we've published this year, things like Shadow of Shiloh, if you're interested in Civil War history. We've got a great book on that. If you're interested in an immigrant's story, we have Maria's Journey that came out earlier this summer about a woman who came to the United States, was in an arranged marriage at age 14, had 10 children. Many of them grew up to be prominent citizens in the state of Indiana and then the nation as well. She was awarded the Sagamore of the Wabash. It's just a really interesting...
This was the woman who came from Mexico.
Yes.
You had a talk about this not too long ago.
Yes, we did. So, you know, there are all sorts of fiction, nonfiction, poetry, history... common things. I'm trying to think what Lou Harry's book is called. There are always some humor books in there as well that we really enjoy having. So it's a wonderful opportunity to come in, do a little bit of gift shopping for yourself or for someone else, get your book signed, talk with the authors. Maybe you have a burning question about a book that they've already written. I know Philip Gully gets that a lot. He's been such a prolific author. People have read a lot of his books and have questions about it. So we want to encourage people to do that. We'll have an author presentation grouping going on in the theater. And then we're doing another youth writing contest. So people still have the opportunity to come to our website and get more information on that if their children would like to have a chance to read their story during the author fair.
Wow. How are you staying sane during all this? I mean, your
breathing
staff
through
is
the
not
nose,
that
out through
big.
The mouth.
We're delegating. There's lots and lots of delegating going
I'm
on.
I'm seeing some interns somewhere. Yeah. What's the high time? What's your peak visitor time? Is it summer?
Well, I think right now we're still figuring that out. We only opened the Indiana Experience this past spring.
Right.
We definitely saw a lot of school kids come through, and we are anticipating a lot more school kids coming in this fall. But really, it's just been a good experience all the way around, and there have been surprise days and not surprising days. But it's so nice to be in the History Center now and to have it be filled with people and so much life and this wonderful interest that everyone has in history and getting involved with history in new and fun ways, because I think we are doing that really well. We're giving people the opportunity to connect in really personal ways and to shape their own experience while they're with us.
You know, it's an interesting evolution in your identity, in that to be the Historical Society suggests a place that scholars might come, but having the History Center be sort of a hybrid between a museum and a research facility creates something a little bit different. Do you have colleagues who have, are there historical societies in other cities that are kind of walking that fine line between those two identities that you've maybe consulted with as you get more public in your programming?
You know, I think this is something that a lot of institutions around the country are walking that line right now, actually, because we're all wanting to make sure that we are as relevant and meaningful to the public as possible. So I think many institutions that had been primarily research institutions are acknowledging that they need to do more and they need to reach a broader audience. And, you know, we've had folks from the Atlanta History Center come and visit us to learn about what we're doing.
Hmm.
When we were planning some of the components of the Indiana Experience, myself and some colleagues went to Chicago, to the Chicago History Museum, to see what they were doing. So there's actually a lot of communication amongst museums, historical societies, and other historical organizations around the nation, checking in on each other and seeing what we're doing. And if nothing else, we're really good at stealing each other's ideas.
Well, and too, changing perception, because, you know, our William Henry Smith Memorial Library has always been open to the public. You know, a fourth grader doing an Indiana history report can come in and use the materials just like a PhD scholar can. So I think part of it is figuring out what people are comfortable doing, too, because we've always invited people into the library, but maybe they aren't comfortable going in and requesting one image at a time, but they'll sit in front of that computer screen in Destination Indiana and really delve into the collection in depth. So finding a way to reach people, and then maybe we do get to introduce them to the library later on down the road or some of our workshops and other programs. So it's really a wonderful entree to make everyone feel comfortable and at ease.
I know that you have school children who come. What sort of resources do you have to work with teachers? Do you have study guides? Do you have online resources?
Yeah, we have some amazing curriculum components on the website that educators can find. Right now, we're actually putting the finishing touches on a new curriculum piece that will celebrate the 200th anniversary of the first successful steamboat voyage down the Ohio River. We've partnered with the Rivers Institute at Hanover College to create a new traveling exhibit, and going along with that is a curriculum piece that's about transportation and how the opening of the West, because once upon a time Indiana was the West, the opening of the West really helped pave the way for American expansion. So we have a lot of great stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's free.
And it's free, absolutely free.
Free is good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's changed for you? I know, Erin, you've been with the Historical Society how long?
Going on 7 years.
And Amy, not quite that
Almost
long.
Almost five.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What's changed for you internally as you open your doors a little bit wider? Are there questions you have to remember to ask yourself that maybe you didn't before you started being a little changing your messages?
Well, I think we're definitely casting a wider net, especially with regard to, you know, marketing and finding niche audiences, but also with programming. You know, we're finding ways to broaden that audience. We've always been very, very good at collecting some of those niche audiences, whether it's, you know, Civil War history or civil rights history. You know, there are lots of different pockets within the city, but I think we're really finding a broader appeal for people, and then that also opens up dialogue so that Erin, you know, after a program, if someone's talking with her about it, may end up with a great idea for yet another workshop or program.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's definitely more of a concerted effort going on these days to use the past to understand the present. Like Amy said, we've always been fortunate and blessed to work with groups that are interested in niche pockets of history. But there are lots of people out there that really don't think of themselves as history lovers, but they certainly understand this notion of the past and connecting to the past in some way. So what we want to help them do is to think about the past in ways that help them make sense of today and maybe even help them think about where things might go in the future.
Is there an uptick of interest in the past during election years, during key election years? Or is that anything you've ever tracked on?
I don't know that we've ever tracked on that necessarily. I don't know that it's peaks during election years, but you can certainly see it when certain political topics are hot. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, when immigration was being hotly debated in the General Assembly, there was certainly an interest in immigration history and the immigration mm-hmm. topic. Mm-hmm. And you can see things like that periodically.
Mm. Yeah. And we did just introduce a traveling exhibition called Faces in the Crowd,
yes,
and it
yeah.
talks a lot about the public's interaction, or you as an individual, how you interact with a candidate who's, you know, going on the road and trying to, you know, make his or her case for what they believe in and why you should give them your vote. So I think that there is definitely, it gives us opportunities to bring up things that might not otherwise come to the forefront.
What are you each personally most excited about this fall?
This fall? Well, I have two things. The Indiana Town Hall series, actually launched just recently, but we have two more town hall series coming up in November and December, and these are programs that, well, actually do exactly what I was talking about. We use the past to understand the present, and this year we are looking at the environment and environmental issues that concern Indiana, and the upcoming program that will be on November 18th will focus on urban environmental issues, and then the final program on December 16th will focus on rural environmental issues. So this is a fun way and a civic way for us to engage the public in history and to challenge them to use history maybe a little bit differently than they would. And then I also have to say, every year I look so forward to the Spirit and Place Festival. I enjoy going to festival events, but I also enjoy hosting the Spirit and Place event for the IHS. And this year we're partnering with Indie Fringe and Storytelling Arts of Indiana to host a Jabberwocky, which allows people just to come in and share stories and the theme this year for Spirit in Place is Food for Thought, and our Jabberwocky is all about beer, because beer is food. So we're going to be telling beer and bar stories at the Indiana History Center.
Are you sharing one of your own?
No, I will be busy doing other things.
Good save.
But you can go to the IHS website or the Spirit in Place website, find out more information. We do we are taking reservations for that one because
that's smart.
Yeah. But I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be a fun time.
Let's see. At the Phoenix Theater, where my day job is, we have an annual microbrew festival as a fundraiser. Yeah. And one of the things I love is walking through the crowd and seeing all the T-shirts with slogans. One of the most popular is Benjamin Franklin said, "Beer is proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy."
Absolutely, yeah.
Go beer. Amy, favorites this fall?
Well, actually, you know, as you know, I used to work for the Indianapolis Art Center, so I always have a place in my heart for original artwork. And right now, through February, we have original artwork on display from the Saturday Evening Post that was used for their cover. So that's available whenever people come in during our normal operational hours. And then also this fall, we're going to be displaying several of their holiday covers.
Oh.
So, you know, whether it's Santa at his desk or, you know, Tree in the Christmas Square, that sort of thing. It's just a wonderful nostalgic sort of walk through time. And a lot of people don't realize the Saturday Evening Post is right here in Indianapolis. Their business and operational center is here. So to get a chance to work with them and to bring a little bit of that artwork side of Indiana's past is really exciting.
Introduce a couple of new three or four new generations to those classic covers.
Sure. You know, I've been talking with my mom about this because she's a middle school humanities teacher, and she uses some of those Norman Rockwell paintings in her humanities class.
Really?
So it was really interesting. We sent out our In Perspective, which is our bimonthly newsletter, and she called me when she got it, and she said, you know, I talk about this particular piece with my students. And so she's like, I've got to get a group together. We've got to come up and see that. So you never know what is going to connect people to what you're doing. So it's just another way for us to get a different kind of audience through.
Sharon Gamble with Amy Lamb and Aaron Kelly of the Indiana Historical Society. Find out more about all the programs and exhibitions at the Indiana History Center at indianahistory.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4. I'll chat with William Fisher, the new chair of the Butler Theater Program.
And just in time for Halloween, I'll talk with horror novelist Jonathan Jans.
I'll also talk with Butler Creative Writing Professor Michael Daly. Plus, there's our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.